All right, let's head over to the Zoom line. Mark Stansberry, National Energy Talk, on the line with us. He's also a columnist for the Oil Man magazine and consults and film makes and documentary makes and all kinds of good stuff. How are you doing today, sir?
Oh, Jason, great to hear your voice and great to be on the Crude Life.
Well, National Energy Talk, we'll talk about that in just a second, but let's start with the documentary. Yes. On Gray Fredrickson did on the oil and gas industry. Let's give that a quick plug so people, if they want to check it out and a number of different things, because it not only is it really important to, you know, the industry, but it's important to our relationship, and also everybody should just see it.
Well, that's wonderful, Jason, you brought that up, and I know that you got to meet Gray Fredrickson, who's a producer, along with myself, of the film, and you got to interview and get to meet with Gray on set, and so during Sherwood Forest Top Secret, and it's called Sherwood Forest Top Secret, and it's on PBS.org, NETA, which is NETA. That's the coverage is about 350 stations or so. It started off with OETA, or Oklahoma Public Broadcasting, in December 29th of 2022. And then it went off on to PBS and to these other stations as well. And my understanding is it's going to be shown in all the schools in Oklahoma, as far as the grade schools. The story is, Jason, as you know, it was based in 1943 when 44 oil men from Roughnecks from Oklahoma were commissioned to go to Sherwood Forest, England, to help, because England did not have the ingenuity in sense of being able to drill wells as fast as the Americans and as successfully as Americans. So 44 Roughnecks went over in 1943. And at the time, in Sherwood Forest, it was producing a little over 150 to 300 barrels of oil per day on the max side. And within a year and a half, there was 100 wells drilled to increase the production to around 3,000 barrels of oil per day. The oil wound up being used in D-Day. And so there was a historical event, life-threatening event to a certain degree. We got footage from British Petroleum, from their archives in London, where they had actually shot footage, both real and both the photography. And so we used colorization for the film. We had 58 cast and crew, and the cast mainly from Oklahoma. We had some from California, and Emmy-winning director Greg Millott, Sean Lynch, who's a production manager and leader as well. And of course, the great Gray Fredrickson, who produced Godfather 2, all the Godfather movies he was part of. And then Apocalypse Now got nominated for an Oscar there. And he got an Emmy for a film that we formed a company in 2001 called Graymark. So Graymark wound up down the road to come up with an Emmy for a film called Robert S. Kerr, Dream No Little Dream. That was in 2008. Main supporter of that was, many of you know, Aubrey McClendon. And he put a lot of the funding up for that. And then it was circulated across the U.S. And then we did another film called The Green Energy Transition, a documentary. And that film was well circulated. It was based on Robert Heffner III. We had Ted Turner, who was a supporter of it, financial supporter, Boone Pickens, and Aubrey McClendon again. And then as of late, the documentary, energy documentary, Sherwood Forest, we're very proud of that. We've got an Emmy nomination for that. Gray was dying of cancer at the end of 2022. And during his hospice care and so forth, he was able to see before that, just shortly before that, the film. He approved the film, And then he died November 20th. The service was December 2nd, and we showed it for the first time publicly, as far as on air, that is, December 29th. Prior to that, we did have a theatrical release in Oklahoma City, where all the cast and crew got to show up, and that was wonderful, and their families, and it was downtown Oklahoma City at one of the theaters there, and it was very well received. We also were nominated and received each year. The Oklahoma Movie Hall of Fame selects one or two films as best films for induction into the Oklahoma Movie Hall of Fame, and Sherwood Forest was selected for that as well. So I represented Gray. I was going to. I wound up getting ill, so I represented him from the standpoint of in name to be presented the award, but was not at the event, the red carpet event for the Oklahoma Movie Hall of Fame. But we did receive that as well. So I appreciate Gray and his efforts for putting this together. It's a unbelievable historical film that you got to see part of it, Jason, in real life, as far as it being filmed, at least the interview. You got to see the interview with Gray. So he was really pleased to meet you, and it was important to him that he got to visit with you.
Well, and I really appreciate the experience and getting a kind of a behind the scenes. And one of the questions I had for you was, where's it now? Is it something that somebody can go online and
go to pbs.org, type in Sherwood Forest Top Secret, okay, or go Sherwood Forest Top Secret. And you basically follow the directions, get you on pbs.org. Also Netta. Yeah, I believe it's netta.org. It's either Netta or I think it is netta.org, N-E-T-A, but Netta. And they also have it. And but you can find excerpts from it, but you can see the full length and any time. So yes, I hope people will go to it. Give us your feedback. It's definitely a very historical film, one that impacted the lives in the 40s, but continues the story. We call the Roughnecks now Oil Patch Warriors. There's a statue of an oil patch warrior, one of the Roughnecks of Sherwood Forest, American, that's in England, Sherwood Forest in England. And then there's one in Ardmore, Oklahoma. It's about a 7-foot statue in a park that represents and recognizes those that were part of the effort to drill wells. There's only one life that was lost, and that was on one of the rigs. It wasn't because of a war effort, directly war effort, but definitely on one of the rigs. And he was buried in England, and recognized for his leadership of going over there as well. So it's very interesting because, Jason, they had to live in a monastery, the Roughnecks, because they were trying to be undercover and all this. And so they became familiar with the townspeople, and you had to camouflage the rigs and the activity. And then they still wound up producing over 100 wells, with building up the production in a year and a half to 3,000 barrels of oil per day. Quite an effort, quite a success story.
Rough number here. How many movies would you say Gray Fredrickson has done in his lifetime?
I would say it's in around the 50-60 range.
Okay.
But they're more of the feature films.
Major. Godfather. Well, Major.
Godfather. All three Godfathers. Godfather II, you got the Academy Award. Yeah.
The reason I bring it up is because, I've been – I was in the media before I got into oil and gas. So I've been I've been interviewing people of all walks of life, from Ricky Nelson's children, Matthew and Gunnar Nelson. And, I was President Obama's deal and George Bush's deal. So all kinds of different varieties. But, Gray Fredrickson is Usually in my list of top people I've interviewed, but not for the reason you'd think, because one of my favorite movies growing up as a child was called UHF, starring Weird Al Yankovic.
He loved him.
And Ray Fredrickson was the producer of it. And so he'll always have a special place in my heart for giving me Wheel of Fish and Spatula City and all these just awesome moments from UHF. So,
I'm so thrilled about that because I got to meet Weird Al in California. Gray introduced me to him, but it was crazy because I had not seen UHF even at the time, years later. And so then I wound up watching it because it was so intriguing, to hear all about it. And Gray actually got a gold record for that. He was a producer of the film. It's just amazing.
That movie at its time was such a cult following. Had such a cult following. And
I was really excited. I wasn't part of it in the earlier days.
That was a great show. But I bring that up because, Gray Fredrickson, Brock Lesnar, I've got some pretty unique people I've interviewed throughout my lifetime.
Yes, you have.
But you're going on a decade now of this podcast and covering the oil and gas industry and doing these different things.
It's actually 10 years with Oil Man. And then
10 years with Oil Man. Okay. That's what the 10 year anniversary was.
Yeah. That's the 10th anniversary, but probably some listeners, it may feel like 10 years for the podcast,
How long have you been doing the podcast?
4 to 5 years. I had one podcast that's several years ago. I started called The Journey of Life, and it was more impactful about individual accomplishments, that stuff, that kind of thing. And I did that. So that was, I would say, a good 7 years I've been involved, probably podcast. But then I have another called Newscape Hiring Advisors, and then the Energy Fellows, which I was part of. But now really focused on National Energy Talk. Yes. So the last 4 to 5 years.
So when you're taking a look at the last decade of things that you've written about and interviews you've done and people you've seen and covered, what's one or two that stands out over the last 10 years is kind of, like the UHF connection or something that, that was a bit unusual, I'll give you one example quick for me. I interviewed a guy that was doing some experimental microwave fracking in Colorado. And I thought, whoa, now you got my attention. I don't know what it means, but
Same here.
Well, so do you have anything like that?
Yeah. Well, I can't match yours. I will say that that's pretty unique. I would say that one of my favorites is with Barry Corbin. Barry has been in over 225 films, close to 250, everything from Urban Cowboy to Yellowstone. He's been involved with film after film, and mainly a character actor. But he was our narrator for Sherwood Forest, Top Secret, and he did an outstanding job. I loved his history, and he's friends with so many different folks along the way. Sam Elliott's one of his best friends, and he talked about relationship he had with different actors and how he worked with them and as far as business opportunities and so forth. And he was originally from West Texas and wound up actually going to New York and becoming a part of Shakespeare Theater for around 10 years and then came back to, I guess, Texas and then wound up in, got in the military as well and wound up in California. He was 40 years old when he got the role in Urban Cowboy. And then he got nominated 2 times for Northern Exposure. War Games, one I liked. I saw him in War Games. I thought he was outstanding in that. It was in Urban Cowboy. But that was fascinating. Of course, even with Gray Fredrickson, interviewing Gray, his dad was in the oil and gas business, a driller, operator, that is. And his granddad was vice president of ONG, one of the founders of Oklahoma Natural Gas. His grandfather. So there was some good history there. I'd go on and on. There There's so many that, and yours as well, Jason. You always do a great interview. And so that's a highlight as well.
I tell you, I would put Maurice Minifield up there on my, oh boy, I'd get all giddy. Northern Exposure is one of those guilty pleasure shows. I think I have every season on DVD.
Oh, really? Wow. We'll tie you up with Barry when he's doing. We'll have a get to meet with Barry and talk about that because
he would
like to meet you. I know that.
I would drive to him. He was in Saul Goodman, one of my favorite shows.
It's interesting because when you say that, I got involved really. We did a film called Trail End, and that's he said that's one of his favorite. It's a short film, but I was a consulting producer back in 2007, and he did an outstanding job in that. In fact, it won the World Fest, International World Fest in Houston for the top short film of that year. And he was an actor in that film, not a narrator. And he was the sole actor. He did such a great job. I mean, he led the whole thing. So he got the Icon Award for his efforts through the years in Wichita, Kansas last fall. And I was able to go to that and see him get that award. And they showed Trail End, which I was real pleased, and brought back some of the cast and the producer, directors, and things like that. So, yes, we'll make arrangements on that for sure.
Oh, that would be fantastic. I used to make fun of people that watched Northern Exposure, and then I saw it in syndication and fell in love with it. And like I say, and actually, because of the Native American music involved in the show, that's why you can't find it anywhere on streaming services. They don't have the music rights with all the individual tribes worked out. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I thought, oh, so here I have all these DVDs, and actually I have a DVD player specifically just for Northern Exposure, because I'll just put it on in the background when I'm cleaning, because the dialogue and the writing is so good. But I bring it up because when you think about a true American, like if you were going to carve out an American and describe it to someone, a lot of people would talk John Wayne, right?
Right,
a lot
right.
of people would point to John Wayne as that model American, you know, type of a thing. Well, to me, it's Maurice Minifield from Northern Exposure. Everything that man represented about manifest destiny and go up into Alaska and buy a bunch of acreage and really try to create opportunity for people while still making a buck and all kinds of stuff. Oh, I loved his character. One of my all-time favorite characters in all of television, Maurice Minifield.
Well, I'm glad to know that. That's fantastic.
But hey, Saul Goodman is too. So
no, I got you. No question.
Well, let's get to your show here. Some of the topics you think that maybe you talked about over the last decade that either through your writing or through your podcast that,
yeah.
I mean, you think about it, we had the downturn, we had the pandemic, we've
oh my
had
goodness, yes. Yeah.
Export tariffs lift, we have export bans, we've had foreign ownership down in the Gulf, all kinds of Keystone, DAPL, boy, you name it. I'm starting to realize we're playing duck hunt now all of a sudden.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you asked that. Going back to Old Man Magazine, which I want to thank Emmanuel Sullivan and thank you for your efforts through the years. You've been there well over a decade as well. I think even longer than me. And serve as a contributing editor, and we're the two contributing editors, so I'm proud of that as well, of a great magazine. One of the first articles I wrote, Jason, was on, it's Time to Act. It was entitled Time to Act. And it was talking about where the Chinese were meeting with the Russians. It happened to be they were meeting in China. Well, I had done work both in Russia and China in the oil and gas industry, primarily the oil and gas in Russia, meeting with the Minister of Energy and Yuri Shafratic back in the 90s. And then also in the 90s, it was with the Chinese, there was a natural gas delegation that had met here in Oklahoma, and they invited me to go over to China. And so I started watching how they acted on different things, as far as separately, but together as well. Why I say that is, you know, talking about business relationships. So when I was in China, they really, if they could have their negotiations on their turf, meaning if you signed your agreement together, they wanted to make sure it was signed on their sovereignty in their backyard. And so I noticed that the Chinese and Russians signed an agreement between Putin and the premier over in China, in Shanghai. It was in 2014. And I told Nancy, my wife, I said, I think what I hear is that they're getting ready to join efforts together, just by observation as well, through this meeting they had, because it was really a strong effort. The picture was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So I thought I need to cover that, because from my interpretation, I was part of a deal, Jason, through my company. It's called the Oklahoma Royalty Company. I was CEO. We were one of the first, at that time, small company, to sign an import-export agreement, which were unheard of for small companies, but mainly the big ones, Exxon and others, were working on these. So we had an interpretation of the agreement, both in Chinese as well as English. And we signed the agreement in China, in Hangzhou, China. And it was, again, an import-export agreement for minerals, primarily, or products. We had that for about 5 years. There was a new leader that came in after that, and so we didn't get it renewed. So between 94 and 99, and then in Russia, I was doing some work, 98, 99, during that time frame especially. And that's about the time that Putin had been working in the mayor's office in St. Petersburg, and then he wound up, as you know, being Yeltsin's heir apparent for Russia. And so we started pulling out of China and Russia about the same time, about 1988, 99 time frame. We didn't like what we were seeing. There was a time between 92 and 98, 99 that looked pretty reasonable. Looked like we were going to see some open markets, open free market system at work and that kind of thing. I could walk down the streets of Moscow. I could walk down the streets of Beijing and not feel any danger at all, or even worry about it. It got to the point where I was concerned about different aspects. So I was a small guy in the negotiation side. I started backing out.
This is 93?
So, no, this was, I went to China. See, I went to China in 94. Mm-hmm. They sent a delegation in 93. And I went to Russia in 92. Met with the Ministry of Energy.
When did you back out then? When things got
about 98, 99. Yeah.
Okay. So I was following you then. Yes. My question is, sorry to sidebar on your past recollection.
No, please. But, yeah.
Well, when, you know, anyone who had international business in the 90s, had the same story for the most part, that the first half was pretty good, because there was traditional buying signals.
Yeah.
Everybody was playing by the same rules.
Yes, that's right.
Then all of a sudden NAFTA happened, and then the stories either go where they got muscled out, or hey, boy, we consolidated, we merged, we centralized, and we got bigger, 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 and it was great. The government gave us a grant, and it was great. Were you impacted by NAFTA?
You know, I look back, probably was. I was really, at the time, you know, it seemed the thing to be part of. So, I mean, the history at the first part of NAFTA, I was going, yes, let's get this done. And by the end, I'm going, it's not working. Not the way.
Can you imagine that, by the way, imagine that. Something else the government led the charge on
not
didn't
funny
work.
At all. It's not funny
sounded
at all.
Like a great idea, but then it just didn't work out. But here's the what I'm talking about is it did work out for some.
Yes, it did. And it was really interesting. When I wrote this article, it was a 2-page article. It had pictures of the flags of China and Russia, and it had Yeltsin and, I mean, excuse me, had Putin and the premier China toasting each other. And the means of toasting and the means of negotiation on their turf meant they're going to be a strong force to contend with by joining efforts. So my interpretation in that article was they have just joined hands to become the major power of the future. And so that was 10 years ago, and today they are definitely working for that goal together. So that was really, and then I wrote an article after that on Ukraine and talked about that, and then Mexico about what they were going through, and what, you know, at one point they were definitely looking at being a privatized and then become, getting away from more of the bid system where they could bid on oil and gas leases and so forth. And that went away, came back, then went away again. So we've seen a lot in the last, you and I have, and the public, especially energy folks, have seen a lot in the last 10 years alone, for sure.
It's been rather interesting because, you know, we've seen such a change in the agriculture industry. We've seen such a change in the communication industry, and we've seen a change now in the energy industry. Transportation is going to be next. So go ahead.
Well, I've got to add one more thing because I mentioned it in an article within about a year ago. So I had an office in Washington, D.C. back in the late 90s. And one of my partners was active as a lobbyist. I was not a lobbyist. I was in the government relations side, but more on establishing meetings and negotiation and relationships. And so I was approached by a gentleman who happens to be from Oklahoma, and Vladimir Nodrowski. And Vladimir came up to me and said, "I need your help in Czech Republic." Well, I thought, well, this is nice. I was involved in import and export and those kind of things back then, energy, not only energy related, but import and export of other, even glassware, different things. And so Vladimir came to me and said, "No, we need your help because we want to join NATO." And his roommate back in prison during the day wound up being, Havel, wound up being his roommate in prison back in the day. And he got back to Oklahoma, Vladimir, and he reached out to me and said, "Havel needs some help on this. Can you help?" Well, I go, "No, I probably can't. I don't know people." But it wound up that Sam, my partner, had really good relationships back then with some of the people in the Senate. So we were able to set up a meeting with the majority leader of the Senate. And Klaus, Prime Minister Klaus, represented the Czech Republic and came in to the Capitol. We met. It was Vladimir, myself, Sam, my partner, the four of us met with the majority leader, and wound up getting a commitment at that time. It was only like you have to have 2/3 votes in the Senate to get ratified for NATO. And so at that time, I was going, NATO sounded wonderful, looked great for the future. It was kind of like you're talking about NAFTA. And then, and so it winds up that we helped get that passed by getting, you know, the votes there. It wound up that we only had commitments of maybe 40 U.S. senators, according to the majority leader at the time. Wound up, we got over 2/3 votes by 97, 98 timeframe. So they were added to, Czech Republic was added to the, to NATO. So I really enjoyed being part of that. At the same time, it's got its issues too, you know. So seeing them in part of history in a small way, but part of seeing what's happened in a bigger way, in that way, you know, you see together like yourself, you've seen what's happened, and it's really a tough world we live in.
One of the things the industry has done pretty well is point out all the different benefits that the oil and gas industry specifically has brought to mainstream, to the world, whether it be toothbrushes or transportation or shower curtains, or, you know, you and I have talked about the emergency services and just, you know, mm-hmm. sterilization of needles, all kinds of different things. But One of the ways I think the industry has really kind of fallen behind, one of the ways the industry has really could use some improvement is in public relations.
And no question.
You've got like Oscars and Emmys, and you know, you've got like backgrounds in this type of stuff. And so mm-hmm. I think you're pretty qualified for this. And the way I usually set it up for people is, you know, for the most part, the oil and gas industry is under that state shaming. That's perfectly okay. State sponsored shaming, I call it, where it's okay mm-hmm. to pick on oil and gas, like it was for coal and like it was for cigarettes and like it was for lepers. You know, there's always a modern day leper or a scarlet letter that the state says, it's okay, go ahead. You can go pick on them. That's perfectly fine. And oil and gas has been that for a while. And so when I take a look at, you know, the amount of, you know, record profits they have and just some of the dollars that they've allocated towards public relations, I think they've fallen short. And the example I give, and I want your film background expertise on this, because I think they can do so much in the world of Hollywood and cinema. But the one example I always give, and you're an Oklahoma person, so you have to know about football by osmosis, is that you know, when you take a look at all the bowl games for the last 100 years, there's only one oil company that's sponsored a bowl game, and that's Valero because of San Antonio. That's the only, and it's the Alamo Bowl, and they sponsored it a few years. But if you take away that sponsorship, now one oil and gas company has sponsored a college bowl game. And to me, that's as basic as it comes, because you have 100,000 people collectively sharing a positive experience at the Exxon Mobil Bowl. Oh, that's fantastic. As opposed to getting upset over something that happened in the Gulf 40 years ago.
Right.
That's it. Talk to me about the public relations. What they've done good, what they could probably improve on, and where we could probably go in the next transition with the oil and gas public relations.
Well, you know, I had conversations with, we talked about Oscar winners, Gray being an Oscar winner, and then the Emmys and so forth. And I wish he was around, because he and I had conversation on this, because we produced three films that we thought would be important, and documentaries, the major ones that we did together. To talk about what you're talking about is the Green Energy Transition that we produced was really to talk about the future of natural gas and hydrogen and the future of energy. And so really, we looked at secret material force really can be applied to not only the past, but to the present. Because in the very beginning of the film, it talks about how energy helps from hospitals on. And then Dream No Little Dream, the first film we did together as a documentary, was the same thing. But Gray and I've had conversations about this very issue, is that you're right, Jason. We're not really telling our story as solidly as possible. It's fragmented in a sense. You have different groups talking different ways instead of saying, let's combine our efforts here. We want to talk together and make things happen in a conversational way. Social media, if used properly, can be advantageous. I think that's something that I noticed those that are opposed to fossil fuel and oil and gas are very good at. They definitely can do a 5 second to 30 seconds or a little bit longer little YouTube moment that can really say a few words and make a huge impact. And I don't think we're as good as we should be on that, being able to get more because everything's fragmented to the point that you have, you know, within 30 seconds, you better tell your story. You go past that, you may lose interest. And documentaries are nice, but they're not necessarily going to be reaching everybody. Where social media, and I look myself on the iPhone, I go reel to reel a lot of times going, what's next in the news? You know, I look for 30 seconds, next 30 seconds, next 30 seconds. And I think that's going to be even more and more the future is brief and to the point, and getting all your information out as possible. I've been trying very hard. I had an effort, a campaign called America Needs America's Energy, a few years back, Jason, we wound up having bumper stickers, and we would America needs America's energy, America needs America's oil, America needs America's natural gas, coal, and so forth. And we had bumper stickers for each of those. In my book, America Needs America's Energy, there'd be a decal that went along with my book. And we had those out to thousands of folks, but not enough. And then we wanted to be able to have conversation and could dialogue. We tried to give a lot of this out free. And it wasn't like you have to buy the book or the decals. We handed those out, had some sponsors along the way. And then the podcast and the column, had a radio show for a few years in Tulsa. And so it winds up that I think we looked at from roundtables to conference. I put a conference together called International Energy Policy Conference. I had it for 20 years. Started out at University of Oklahoma in 1992, and we had it for 20 years in 2000 up to 2012. 2002. I'm losing my track here. And well, it was 2012. I'm definitely lost now. It wound up being 20 years, and it was a really good conference. Started out in Oklahoma, but we had conferences in Houston and Dallas and D.C., the same conference, and had speakers, Gene Kirkpatrick, Ambassador Gene Kirkpatrick, UN Ambassador. We had those from overseas, from England and Scotland, Bulgaria, Russia, China, and others came in for this. We even had somebody representing OPEC that came in to be at the meeting. Sarah Akbar was representing OPEC. We had somebody from the World Bank. It was well attended. Well, it was really for stakeholders to get the message out. I say that, I've tried to cover the bases as much as possible to get public education in the forefront. With that said, it's still, I mean, if anything, we're way behind. And so anyone's input to move it to the forefront is very, very, would be very well received by me and others, but it seems detached a lot of times. You know, I'll try to say, let's work on this, and you'll get some attention to it, but not enough. And I know you face that yourself, don't you, Jason? I mean, trying to get the message out.
I do. And one of the things that I find interesting about the Crude Life brand that we've had with oil and gas is we've tried very hard to be non-political for our existence, to where we, you know, we'd have policymakers on, but we wouldn't get political. And we tried to have a news bent and, you know, be as biased and that sort of thing. And it's interesting because the reason we did that was because everybody else got political. And so we did it more from like an entrepreneur. Okay, if the whole market's doing this, well, let's just be the only ones doing this. Mm-hmm. And that's when we took off with our followers and our radio stations, because people wanted kind of non-polarizing information. Now, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that it's sexy and they're sharing, you know, they're liking it and getting in fights over social media posts, but they sure do read it, and they sure mm-hmm. do open the emails. And the mm-hmm. people that, you know, are in charge of certain areas that are key decision makers, they sure do trust this information. So for us, you know, we've always kind of gone down that path. And what's interesting about it is the evolution. When I grew up, energy wasn't political at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, most people really didn't talk about it outside of gas.
That's
prices.
Right. I remember this. Yes. I agree.
I mean, yeah, outside of gas prices. Over the last 15 years, 10 years primarily, energy got very polarizing, to where here, you know, we kind of ended up on an island where we were one of the few that were non-polarizing with our programming. And, you know, so to me, that's quite the story, how energy got so polarizing. Because when I go out and I talk to the average person is pretty, pretty sensible. They're looking
that's
for
right.
kind of things in the middle. You know, they don't necessarily want to be shoved an EV car down their throat, but they'll listen to the argument for it. Sure. Everybody yes. likes to recycle. Everybody likes to be environmental. And so what do you make of this kind of how energy has gotten so polarizing in politics? Mm-hmm. Because it's, you know, I mean, it's part of Maslow, you know, shelter, mm-hmm. food, energy, right? Heat.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, being demonized is really hard to come back from. And once it kicked in, where our industry was so demonized, it's reflective, you know, of across the board in society. So all of a sudden you have opposition, even within the state of Oklahoma, North Dakota, I'm sure you have in North Dakota, those that are going, well, we need to go get away from oil and gas. And I'm going, you're not listening. You're not looking. You've got to look around a little bit. Look at your roads, look at your hospitals, look at your schools. Look, and I like the tie-in you mentioned about agriculture. I mean, look at everything that what comes to the table as far as eating and so forth. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of oil and gas and other forms of energy to make sure we have the necessary food and tools, and you name it, on and on and on. And so I hear, and you do this, I know I do it. I will mention from time to time what products we have, thousands of products, not just a few hundred, that come from petroleum chemicals and so forth. And we just got to keep telling that story. I tell folks maybe one at a time, but and like that friend that I talked about, I've talked to you about in the past, even in a recent podcast, where he was looking at how he demonized the oil and gas industry, and then told him, look around sometime, if you're in a hospital room, look around and see what's there. And sure enough, he had talked to me about his wife being in the hospital. He said, you know, you're right. It was emergency down in Houston, and it winds up, the room is full of plastics. and you know, oxygen and on is supplied by products from the plastic side of things. So it saved her life. So oil and gas is a big deal. And it's not going away anytime soon, no matter what's said.
National Energy Talk, name of the podcast. And you're also doing columns for the Oil Man magazine.
Right.
So what's the biggest story right now? We're talking about energy transition. We're talking about EV vehicles. We're talking about methane, you know, the alphabet agencies, if you will, mm-hmm. the public relations battle. I mean, there's quite the wheel of issues in oil and gas right now. But do you have one that just kind of you see that kind of stands out more than most?
I think the two words energy transition are just, it's because everything goes under that. I mean, you think of carbon sequestration, or it's energy transition. You talk about the oil and gas industry and the future of oil and gas, and how's it tie in with wind or solar, hydrogen. It all goes there. I would say also natural gas is part of that equation that I hear quite a bit about, even though there's the demonized part about methane and so forth. Still comes that to save the world, in a sense, you're going to have a strong natural gas industry, because you have the affordability, the adaptability, the resources in place. The energy transition is going to have to be a big part of the effort, but put under there a really strong subheading is, yes, through natural gas. Because to lead to hydrogen, you have to have natural gas. And the world will be better off having natural gas for, first of all, electricity, heating, fertilizers, on and on. So I see natural gas being more and more of something to look at. I had a recent interview with David Lawler. David is a former president, CEO of Devon. Excuse me. His friend was Devon Energy. He's former president and CEO of BP 48. His good friend, who he served under years ago, is now Rick Muncrief, the president and CEO of Devon Energy. And so David talked really strongly about natural gas, the importance of natural gas. And he didn't address, you know, climate is an issue, and some other areas like that. But it came back to energy transition, even in that article that he talked about. So that's coming out, by the way, if I can get his title right, I think it's actually CEO, Chairman of BP for the U.S., and that was for 9 years. And he's not with BP now. He's 56 years old, got a huge future ahead of him. Doug, his brother, was president of Chesapeake Energy, and his brother is now president of Continental Resources in Oklahoma City. They're wonderful people and doing a great job. And then Rick Muncrief, who's CEO of Devon Energy, is part of that family in a sense of working together through the years. So we have a really strong leadership here in Oklahoma that we're proud of as well.
Natural gas wanted it. Oh, yeah, I thought I was still on mute there for a second. Natural gas. I've never understood kind of the boogeyman that natural gas has been made into. Whether it, you know, I mean, it burns pretty clean.
Yes.
I understand that there's some methane fears, but the capture involved with the technology seems to be there. And just from the simple fact that, you know, it can leak out of the ground.
Right.
I guess my question is, do you think it's because it's associated with crude oil that it's gotten to be such a boogeyman, or do you think so?
I think very strongly. It wasn't in the past. It was you know, coal, oil, and together, and then natural gas, and all of a sudden they started saying, being 4 or 5 years ago, then. Maybe more like 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that the natural gas was part of the issue, tied to oil and tied to coal, and so it was fossil fuels. When in the past it was natural gas that was on its own. I remember as a kid when natural gas first came out in a big way. I was about 13 years old, and there was a big natural gas field in western Oklahoma, Anadarko Basin. And there was a well going to be drilled to 24,000 feet outside my hometown of Elk City, about a mile from Elk City, outside Elk City. And it wound up, the well came in very strongly. And so all of a sudden, our little town became natural gas capital of the world. And so right after that, I got involved with we'll have the opportunity to be an intern staffer for U.S. Senator Dewey Bartlett. And that was intriguing because I didn't know anything, even though I put up decals to say natural gas capital of the world, had around over town as a kid. I really didn't know much about natural gas. I mean, I really didn't. I didn't know much about the oil and gas industry at all. My family didn't come from the oil and gas background. So I wound up going to DC for a while, and I got assigned several projects that had to do with natural gas or oil or whatever. And that was intriguing. Because that got my interest. That's really what piqued my interest, kind of like what you do and the background you've had in journalism and so forth. Once you start reading about energy, you get involved and you see how many things are involved with it and how, you know, take upstream, downstream, midstream, just in the oil and gas side. Then that doesn't touch, you know, the utility side and the service industry and on and on. So it's very involved, very complex. And you can't change it overnight, no matter what anybody wants to do, because you have a natural resources like natural gas that could be in the forefront. We could really help a lot of people stay warm and in the winters in Europe. And why aren't we doing that when you have your opponent is definitely going to make sure they have transported the natural gas. I remember I worked in Bulgaria years ago, and it was called Bulgargas is the name of the company. And they wound up, it was Russian natural gas coming in. So Americans built an underground gas storage facility so there would be natural gas stored during the winter so that you wouldn't get high prices, because the way government was controlled by Russia was increase the prices. So if you increase the prices and you want something done, if Russia wanted something done, that Bulgaria's not going to turn them down. So America had to step in and build some underground storage facilities and things like that. It was basically a war going on then, in a sense of energy war, because they had the natural gas. And here we are, we could be shipping that natural gas, transshipping it from Houston and so forth. But they're saying we can't do it right now. I don't get it. I really don't. We have opportunities right before us. And Jason, I throw up my hands on that. I don't know how you can argue about how we could really make the difference on natural gas alone in Europe and Asia, Japan, all on. Yeah.
Well, it's pretty remarkable because we are exporting it over to, you know, China and other countries, and not to pick on China, but, you know, they are a huge buyer of our natural gas and coal and all these energies that we can't seem to really use here anymore. And
but we're being shut down.
Yeah.
Can't build another facility right now because it's a bad deal to have methane and natural gas. So unless the administration steps forward and says, let's go full throttle on energy, definitely you and I are strong on environmental. We're strong on conservation, but we also are stronger as a country if we're strong on energy. So that's our challenge.
So how do we tackle this when it comes to leadership? Because I just don't think starting, another political action group so they can shout louder than the other one is working. Right. I just don't see that working. Maybe I'm wrong, but every time I go to the store, the prices keep going up. And you know as well as I do, energy costs are one of the main drivers of inflation. Mm-hmm. The Fed has a lot to do with it too, but so do energy costs. And right. Energy costs are dictated by so many different things. And now we're starting to see lawsuits coming from supply chain individuals because, they were going to buy raw materials a couple of years ago to go build this pipeline, and all of a sudden, still waiting on the feds. Well, now the companies are suing each other. Government's mm-hmm. just sitting back and watching it and collecting their attorney fees, I guess. I don't know.
No, you're right.
What's your solution, King Mark Stansberry?
Oh my goodness! Well, I need to. We need a royalty group of two kings working together, Jason and Mark. I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's an old bit in radio. If I was king for a day, I'd do this, and then you'd open the phone lines and it just light up.
Well, king of the day. So yeah, I want to hear from a bunch of folks out there.
Yeah.
It goes back to what we had talked about separately on another podcast about STEM and STEAM. It's getting the younger people, younger generation plugged in because at least that's a big part of it. That's not necessarily the total answer. I mean, by doing the documentaries, social media, the books, whatever, method you want to use, they're important. But when you get down to the classroom and young people, I mean, young people, they go home and they'll tell their parents. They go home and they'll tell their grandparents and on and on. And so you get a lot of buy-in if we just get that story told to the public and as far as children and young people. So I see some initiatives there, but it's the problem with it again, Jason, it's hodgepodge. You got one group that is doing something here in Oklahoma and another group's doing something in Arkansas, another group. But if you could combine those efforts, make it across the board, across the nation, then to me, that's the way to do it. And it's right now it's segmented, it's fractured. And it needs to be a message that's consistent across the board. So we're talking about STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math, along with adding the, as you mentioned, the art, making it STEAM. Then there you've got the buy-in of so many folks that you show them that it's impacting them, both not only in the classroom or what, you know, when they are driving somewhere or transportation or the use of heating oil, it's also impacting their future in the workforce because they're looking at how they can develop as future professionals or technicians, whatever it might be, in the workforce. So it means more. I talked to a young man, he's in his 40s out of Houston recently. He's moved up the ladder. About 20 years ago, he was a roughneck, and now he's behind a desk and working and providing for his family and just doing a great job. But he had to learn the process because his family wasn't involved in oil and gas at all. And it was back then, even there were some negatives from the parents going, "You really want to go in the oil and gas business?" Because back then, it was a matter of being demonized, it was a matter of what the industry is going to do economically. A lot of booms and busts along the way. And so that deterred a lot of the young people. But now it's beyond boom and bust. It's ridicule that they're going to face potentially and so forth. But I see a lot of companies really working, and it may be one company at a time, one person at a time, but it'd be better if we could join efforts and go across the board and get this done with the troops moving.
Well, you got a preview for us for the next episode of the National Energy Podcast?
I do, and it's you. We're going to make sure that you're covered on this deal. You did a great job, by the way, on the last interview, and that's going to be out very soon. So I hope everyone listens, because I think some of the questions you just asked may be answered in my interview with Jason Spies on National Energy Talk, because we covered quite a bit on that show. I think we've covered the other half of what we didn't ask on that show as well on this show. So together, you need to tune into National Energy Talk and the Crude Life. I mean, that's I think it's pretty important.
You know, I'm kind of proud because we didn't really overlap much either.
No, sure haven't.
I mean, it's kind of different topics, but different context, and we really kind of went through the gamut on things too. And so, we'll have to have you back on to talk about what I'd like to talk about actually sometime is kind of where you like to where you see the oil and gas industry going, like where, you know, kind of like I did in yours, where I talked about the print industry and the ag industry.
Oh, that was wonderful. Yeah.
And really, you know, we'll take a half hour and just really boil it down, because I mean, if you went through NAFTA and you know what you're talking about with the Ukraine, and you know what you're talking about with Putin and China. Because I here's what a lot of people don't know is that back in 2007 and 8, I did a show with a guy in China called Cowboys and Dragons.
Wow, and, I love that.
Yeah, he was live in China. We were live in America, and we talk about capitalism. And it was pretty neat. Peter DeCrassel was his name. He had a book out and a number of different things. And it was fascinating, because I was more the producer. I wasn't the host. I was the producer.
That is fascinating. Yes.
And so I learned a lot from the two of them going back and forth about the international market. And of course, anytime you're talking about markets, you're talking energy, monetary, and ag, right? That's what drives most markets. Mm-hmm. And but to me, the media part was fascinating, because the Chinese government, they got some pretty basic rules, and if you're okay with it, yeah, then they'll do business with you.
That's
but
right.
If you don't, you don't right. follow these couple rules, well, then go somewhere else.
That's right. No, that's right. And
anyway,
that'd be fascinating. It'd be great to dialogue, for sure. And I want to definitely keep the dialogue alive. I think a lot of times it's kind of like I tell folks, when you're going to the board meeting, we'll have these retreats. It's a big standard to do this. And it's kind of like our question about public relations, about what we could do. What happens when the board meeting in the board, all the boards I've been involved with, there's always a retreat. Every year we're having a retreat. Well, what happens from the retreat? Well, you have a strategic plan. You have strategic ideas. You have ways to communicate, ways to message. Then what happens? That goes in a file. And then you have a retreat the next year. And so it's like Groundhog Day in the boardroom or retreat. So I think that's happens here. We have good intent. We have great ideas, but we've got to continue to dialogue and communicate them habitually, not just every 6 months or every 3 months. And that's where your Cowboys and Dragons, wow, that's pretty impressive.
You got a sponsor for your podcast you want to give a quick plug to?
Yes, David A. Guest. He's a certified mineral manager here in Oklahoma. And he just recently joined in as a sponsor, David A. Guest.
All right. And how can people get in your podcast and website and contact, all kinds of
stuff? The easiest way is to go to markstansbury.com, and it'll guide you from there as to what we have to offer. And hopefully people will join in and send me some questions and provide some answers or some guidance. And so please keep in touch.